rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I hope you had a marvelous Labor Day, my friends. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on, what is it, Tuesday the 5th of September. 867 days, 12 hours, 52 minutes, 37 seconds until the Constitution mandates that George W. Bush has to leave office. That is, barring impeachment in the interim. EncounterBooks.com, over at their website, is selling books like Darwinian Fairy Tales, Fables of Evolution, Neoconservatism, Why We Need It, and a new book, The God That Did Not Fail, How Religion Built and Sustains the West, by Robert Royal. And Robert Royal is with us on the line this morning. Hey, Robert, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
This is a fascinating premise. Tell us, what is the God that did not fail?
Well, as you know, this is a playoff title of an earlier book, The God That Failed, which was written back in the 1950s by several ex-communists. And what I wanted to do in this book was to just kind of calm people down a little bit who, on both sides of the kind of religion and politics debate. That in the 1950s, a kind of God that failed was communism. In our time, people are worried that religion is in deep trouble, and it is in trouble in a variety of ways. But I think it's probably fair to say that after all the acids of modernity, you know, Freudianism, Darwinism, Marxism, all the existentialism, all such
capitalism,
stuff, capitalism, popular culture, television, that religion has survived in the United States, and even to a certain extent, although religion is not tied to denominations the way it is in the United States and Europe, it's even survived in Europe.
And well, throughout the world, I would argue that spirituality has survived.
Yeah.
That certainly religion has survived as an institution, but I think that there's a real significant distinction to be made between religion as an institutional entity and spirituality as a personal experience.
Right.
I may be wrong on this, but I suspect that spirituality is a virtually nearly universal experience, although people may describe it differently. But, you know, I don't think anybody can stand out in a night sky and look up without getting that feeling,
yeah.
You know, and at its very coarsest. I mean, that's just like the most common of the experiences, and that the spiritual experience is just something that unites us all as humans. When that spiritual impulse, however, gets twisted around by some guy coming along and saying, you know that great feeling you had? Well, that came from my God, and he only talks through me, and I'm the guy to tell you which way to go and what to do and who to vote for, then we've got a problem.
Well, I agree with you up to a point, but if we think that religion is sort of built in to human beings, which I think any anthropologist would tell you is the case, it's also the case that people tend to try to understand their experiences, and of course they're going to come out with, you know, they're going to parse it out in different ways. But it's sort of a particularly modern American and mostly modern European, because the rest of the world is not buying this kind of spirituality thing that you're talking about. The rest of the world is still tied to larger scale expressions of, you know, what people sometimes call organized religion.
Respectfully, Robert, I disagree. I have lived and worked on five continents, I spent a week with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala. These people are, frankly, more about spirituality than they are about religion.
Well, I mean, the Dalai Lama is a part of a.
Okay, I've worked with tribal
tradition.
People in Central Africa who have never heard of any organized religion,
right.
and they're intensely spiritual.
Yeah, they've got we could debate about what spirituality is and what religion is, but you're going to find that the tribes in Africa do not practice individual styles of religion. They've got some sort of communal expression of it. All this is just to say, though, that much of the fear, you know, the kind of desperation, as you rightly described, that people want to politicize religion, I think needs to be rethought and much more calmly rethought, because I think this is going to remain a persistent dimension of human behavior. There's nothing that's out there in the social science literature that gives us any other indication of what's going on. It may very well be that spirituality will remain kind of the dominant element for a while, but I have a feeling that the more institutional, or at least the more communal side, is likely to sneak back in as well. And so What I've done here is two things. I've tried to emphasize for people who are worried that, in fact, that there is that persistence, that God did not fail despite all the things that we think we're going to knock him out. And the second thing is I try to tell a story a bit about the West that's a little bit less of a cartoon story. I mean, we tend to think of religion as, you know, crusades and Spanish Inquisitions and Galileo. There's a great deal more to religiosity, both in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, ancient Greece and Rome, than people usually give it credit for being. And if you begin to go back and look at some of that stuff, it's quite interesting.
You mentioned ancient Greece and Rome. The title is The God That Did Not Fail, but both of those societies believe they were polytheistic. They believed in gods.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no. I think if you go back and you look at the great thinkers that we admire so much and why we are still interested in Greece and Rome, they kind of inherit this set of stories. And yet they kind of know that the world has got to be all one piece and maybe it's all got to fit together somehow. And just as if you talk to Native Americans, you know, they'll have a bunch of stories about different gods, but they'll tell you that ultimately there's one kind of supreme god. I think that in the development of even pagan cultures, there tends to emerge that kind of implicit monotheism.
So you think monotheism is the natural state of things? Excuse me.
Well, it's a big world. You know, there are societies that really emphasize multiplicity for various reasons. There are societies that, at one period or another, will tend to emphasize unities. And our society tends to be at a period where it's emphasizing multiplicity more than unity.
Interesting. The big debate among the found, we're talking with Robert Royal. He's the author of The God That Did Not Fail. Excuse me, I ate a pear just before going on the air, which I shouldn't have done. I'm chewing up the seeds, and I think I have a piece of it stuck in my throat. The debate between Jefferson and Madison was Jefferson was afraid that if the religious, he had seen the experience of Massachusetts, you know, being basically run as a theological state in the 1600s, women being burned at the stake and or hung, actually, but more often than not as witches. And he was concerned about, quote, the religious, end quote, seizing political power. And Madison, on the other hand, didn't think that Americans would be dumb enough to let that happen. But he was concerned about the government giving money to churches. In fact, his first veto as president in 1811 was to veto an act that gave money to churches in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor. He said this should be a purely secular civic function, that the government itself should provide this function rather than giving money to churches. Because if we give money to churches, Madison, who was a Christian, I mean, Jefferson was a deist, but Madison was openly a Christian, he was concerned that it would corrupt religion. What's your take on that argument, Robert Royal?
Well, look, there are problems with the one and with the other. Jefferson was a very intelligent man. He predicted that America would be Unitarian. There was not a young man alive in his time, he said, who would not die Unitarian. That didn't exactly work out, and I think this shows us one of the limits of rational analysis of a given situation. Madison, I think Madison did something slightly different than what you're talking about. He didn't say that the government should do these things in a secular sense. He just said that the government should not get entangled with religion because he was worried about religion. He was a great student, as you know, Jonathan Witherspoon's at Princeton. He was a Baptist, and he believed that there were dangers to religion. Now, you know,
Well, here's actually his veto message to Congress. He said, because the said bill invests said incorporated church an authority to provide for the support of the poor and education of poor children, it would be a precedent for giving to religious societies and as such a legal agency in carrying into effect what should be a public and civil duty. End
well,
quote.
Yeah, well, I mean,
February 21, 1811.
Yeah, there also should be, of course, religious duties to help out the poor.
But not funded by the state.
Yeah, not funded by the state. Look, the problem here is this. We're a society that believes in free speech, that believes in pluralism. Does pluralism mean that religious voices have a right to speak out in public? I believe that they do. Does pluralism mean that the state needs to support religious activities? Here we get into, of course, a very much thornier operation. There are charitable organizations that have been.
We do that with tax breaks.
Yeah, but there are charitable organizations that have been receiving governmental monies for years and years, over a century in the United States, to carry out secular functions. And as we know, as long as the functions are predominantly secular and they're not predominantly religious, there doesn't seem to be much of an entanglement. But this is the kind of debate. I don't think you arrive at an exact definition here. I think this is the kind of debate that every age has to go through. And at certain points, certain functions can be better carried out by some partnership between religion and the state. At certain points, you have to let one or the other go on by itself.
Yeah. I respectfully disagree. I think that the two should be separate. The nonprofit organizations should be secular if they're going to be getting money from the federal government. But we'll have to leave it at that, just with that respectful disagreement. The book, The God That Did Not Fail, How Religion Built and Sustains the West, Robert Royal. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been working on vacation, chasing hares and moles. Cindy, she had notwithstanding, and I never read the polls. What's the point? I've made no mistakes I know of. That's just not like me. I subscribe to presidential infallibility.
Ah, yes, the Bush Doctrine. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the program, brought to you today by the Sacred Grounds Coffee. Saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532, their telephone number. SacredGroundsCoffee.com, their website. And the show powered today by Sacred Grounds Coffee, too. 1-800-425-2532, their number. And Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh at 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS and smalldog.com. Right here on listener-supported radio, supported by you, the listeners, supporting our sponsors. So, and our local sponsors as well, all those whose names you don't hear me saying, because the local radio station has sold the ad, please support them as well. The facts of Bill Clinton and Osama bin Laden are as follows. Very straightforward. Here's the fact. Actual history. According to the 9/11 Commission, now this is, there was this moment when there was a camp in Afghanistan that was thought to be, this is the mythology, that they thought that Osama bin Laden was there and maybe he could have been taken out, okay? Now, the actual history, according to the 9/11 Commission report, in fact, if you read page 911, it just, lays the whole thing out. According to the 9/11 Commission report, then CIA Director George Tenet had authority from Bill Clinton to kill Osama bin Laden anywhere he found him, anytime he found him, under any circumstances. If you can kill this guy, do it, essentially is what Bill Clinton had said to George Tenet. And Robert Cressy, the former director of the National Security Council for counterterrorism, wrote, quote, Mr. Clinton approved every request made of him by the CIA and the U.S. military involving force against bin Laden and al-Qaeda. In other words, every time the CIA came to Bill Clinton and said, we may have an opportunity to kill bin Laden, or we may know some way of killing bin Laden, or, we have an eye, here, maybe bin Laden is here. Every single time, Clinton said, great, do it. There was never a time when Bill Clinton said, no, I don't think we ought to do that. Never a time. Never happened. You following me on this? I mean, this. Let's just be absolutely unambiguous about this. There was never a time when Bill Clinton said, no, don't kill Osama bin Laden. Standing orders to the CIA, take this guy out, if at all possible. Okay, this is not in dispute. Page 199 of the 9/11, the official 9/11 report. President Bush told us, he asked Tenet whether the CIA could kill bin Laden, and Tenet replied that killing bin Laden would have an effect but would not end the threat. President Bush told us, Tenet said to him that the CIA had all the authority it needed. In December, Bush met with Clinton for a two-hour one-on-one discussion of national security and foreign policy changes. Now, keep in mind, this is after the elections in November, before Bush becomes president in January. I'm reading from the 9/11 Commission report. In December, Bush met with Clinton for a two-hour one-on-one discussion of national security and foreign policy challenges. Clinton recalled saying to Bush, quote, "I think you will find that by far your biggest threat is bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda," end quote. Clinton told us he also said, quote, "One of the great regrets of my presidency is that I didn't get him for you because I tried to," end of quote. Bush told the commission that he felt sure President Clinton had mentioned terrorism, but did not remember much being said about Al-Qaeda. Bush recalled that Clinton had emphasized issues such as North Korea and the Israeli peace process. In January, Clark briefed Rice on terrorism. He gave similar presentations describing Al-Qaeda as both an adaptable global network of jihadist organizations and a lethal core terrorist organization, to Vice President-elect Cheney, to Hadley, and to Secretary of State designate Powell. One line in the briefing slides said that Al-Qaeda had sleeper cells in more than 40 countries, including the United States. Berger told us he made a point of dropping in on Clark's briefing to Rice to emphasize the importance of the issue. Later that same day, Berger met with Rice. Now, I met with Sandy Berger. He told me the same story, by the way. He says that he told her that the Bush administration would spend more time on terrorism in general and Al-Qaeda in particular than anything else. Clark said that the new team, having been out of government for 8 years, had a steep learning curve to understand Al-Qaeda and the new transnational terrorist threat. And they go through this whole thing about how, you know, Roger Cressy, special briefing on terrorist threat, all this stuff, and that every time Clinton was given an opportunity to kill bin Laden, he took it. Now, knowing that history and having that background, I got to tell you what ABC, the lies that ABC Television Network is going to put on the air. Well, actually, it's called fiction, so I guess you can really truly call it lies. It's going to put on the air on 9/11 and what you can do about it in our activism alert right after this. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no! Corporations should not have the rights of persons. So, anyhow, here's the story as the 9/11 Commission tells it, as history tells it, as Richard Clark tells it, the former counterterrorism czar for Bush 1, for Clinton and Bush 2. Number one, no military or CIA personnel were on the ground in Afghanistan and saw bin Laden. Number one. Number two, this from Richard Clark himself, right, the counterterrorism czar. No military or CIA personnel were on the ground in Afghanistan and saw bin Laden. Number two, the head of the Northern Alliance, Massoud, was nowhere near an alleged bin Laden camp and never saw bin Laden. And number three, the CIA director said he could not recommend a strike on a camp because the information was single-sourced and he'd have no way to know if bin Laden was there by the time a cruise missile hit it. In other words, Bill Clinton never flinched. Bill Clinton never said, oh, no, don't kill him. And there was never evidence that bin Laden was in a particular camp, and the Northern Alliance never had anything to do with it. Now, here is the way Rush Limbaugh describes this. Apparently, he's seen an early version of it, sees this movie that ABC is going to play on 9/11. Quoting Limbaugh, "So the CIA, the Northern Alliance, surrounding a house where bin Laden is in Afghanistan, they're on the verge of capturing, but they need final approval from the Clinton administration in order to proceed. So they found Washington. They found a White House. Clinton and his senior staff refused to give authorization for the capture of bin Laden because they're a prey to political fallout if the mission should go wrong and if civilians were harmed. Now, the CIA agent in this is portrayed as being astonished. Are you kidding? He asks Sandy Berger over and over, is this really what you guys want? Berger then doesn't answer after giving his first admonition, you guys go it on your own. If you go in, we're not sanctioning this, we're not approving this, and Berger just hangs up on the agent without answering any, after not answering any of his questions. End of quote from Limbaugh describing the movie. So Think Progress, Center for American Progress, goes to Richard Clark, who is the former counterterrorism czar for Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and Bill Clinton, and is now a counterterrorism advisor to ABC, who's filming the movie, or who's airing the movie. This movie made, by the way, by Cyrus Narashte, who is now claiming that it is a docudrama. It is not actually a depiction of what happened. It is a, it's a movie. It's drama. Although it was originally billed as an objective telling of the events of 9/11. Right. Then later he goes on his blog, on the ABC blog, which ABC just took down, by the way. I'm not kidding you. They took down the blog. David Cunningham goes on there. He says, this is not a documentary. He says, the redundant statement about Clinton and the emphasis to protect his legacy instead of trying to learn about the failures of both administrations smells of agenda. Watch the movie and then it'll start. Yeah, right. And Cyrus, the guy who wrote the movie, says, this movie is well-supported and well-documented, but everybody should be aware, and we say so up front in the long legend, quote, the following dramatization has composite and representative characters and incidents, and time compressions have been used for dramatic purposes, end quote. Whoever wants to write or talk about this movie is free to do so. We've been very open in talking with them. We can't control who writes what. Well, then ABC pulls the blog. So anyhow, I shared with you what actually happened. Then I shared with you what Limbaugh said happened, which is basically it was all Clinton's fault. And here is what Richard Clark said. Number one, contrary to the movie, no U.S. military or CIA personnel were on the ground in Afghanistan and saw bin Laden. Number two, contrary to the movie, the head of the Northern Alliance, Massoud, was nowhere near the alleged bin Laden camp and did not see Osama bin Laden. Number three, contrary to the movie, the CIA director actually said he could not recommend a strike on the camp because the information was single-sourced and we would have no way to know if bin Laden was in the target area by the time a cruise missile hit it. At the same time, CIA Director George Tenet told the 9/11 Commission that he had full authority from President Clinton to kill bin Laden, anytime, anywhere. As Roger Cressy, head of the NSC, said, the National Security Council Director for Counterterrorism, wrote, Mr. Clinton approved every request made of me by the CIA and the U.S. military involving using force against bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Not what the movie says, just what's real. So, our activism alert for the day. Yeah, well, if not taking over, at least having our voices heard. If you go to thinkprogress.org, the blog of the Center for American Progress, they have a link there where you can actually send an email to ABC, to ABC Television saying, hey, tell the truth about 9/11. We're sick of all these lies. We're sick of the Bush administration hyping this thing. And we're frankly horrified that a major news network would be public, would be running a two-part docudrama on 9/11, written by an admitted right-winger, a, quote, friend of mine, end quote, of, as Rush Limbaugh refers to him, that makes it look like Bill Clinton was responsible for 9/11 when it actually happened on the watch of George W. Bush. So you can get over to thinkprogress.org and make your opinions known. Let them know what you think. Tell them what's going on. Because I think this is tragic. And you know, along the same veins, you know, do we have news anymore, or do we have infotainment? Front page of today's Wall Street Journal, article by Brooks Barnes. CBS and Katie Couric have already made sweet music together. Yeah, this is the guy, James Horner, who is the composer for the theme music of the Titanic. He's written over the scores or songs for more than 100 movies. And for the last 3 months, He's been working on what he says is the biggest challenge of his career, writing a 10-second clip of music that will introduce Katie Couric each weeknight on the CBS Evening News. I am trying very hard not to prejudge this. But, you know, the fact of the matter is CBS was the first network to take news out of the out from behind a firewall and put it into the entertainment division. This was a decade ago, as I recall. We no longer have news at the network level in the United States. We have infotainment. We don't have journalists asking the question, is this news that's actually going to affect people's lives? We instead have programming directors and vice presidents of entertainment making decisions for news divisions about, will this draw more eyeballs? Does this guy's presentation, is this guy's presentation more passionate? Will he get more viewers and thus more advertising revenue than just a guy who tells the truth about the news? Should we, like MSNBC did, dump something like Phil Donahue, a current affairs show, because it's anti-war, and MSNBC just happens to be owned by General Electric, which is a major defense contractor? Anyhow, I'm really trying to wait a few days, check it out, and see if Katie Couric can actually be a news person, be a journalist. But I got to tell you, it really concerns me when I'm seeing the, you know, front page story here at the Wall Street Journal about this new CBS Evening News, and it's all about what the music is going to be. As Rome Hartman, the program's executive producer, no relationship to me, says, it must be urgent and serious, yet light, flexible, yet memorable, regal, encompassing, and encompassing the grand history of CBS News, yet moving forward. The music shouldn't sound too similar to the Roman fanfares of NBC and ABC, Mr. Horner says, adding, Katie told me she wanted something that reminded her of wheat fields blowing rather than Manhattan skyline. Now, when all the other journalists in America were out going to Lebanon to see what kind of havoc was being wreaked by the battle between Israel and Hezbollah, when all the other journalists in the world were going to Iraq to find out what's actually going on the ground in Iraq, when all the other journalists in the world were going down to Mexico City to watch the theft of an election by right-wing forces being advised by Republican campaign strategists, when all the other journalists in the world were in London talking with members of parliament about their horrors at Blair toadying up to George Bush again, Katie Couric made a tour of America to ask Americans what they want to hear on the news. It is, is this the death knell of news? If the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric turns into another Rita Cosby, another infotainment show, and gets more eyeballs because Americans have become so used to pablum and they love those Fox-like production values, will the other networks follow? I would say they already have to a large extent. And is that the end of democracy? 45 minutes past the hour.
You got to fight for your rights. You can't bury your head in the sand. You got to fight for your rights. You can't just bury your head in the sand. Politics and religious superstition go hand in hand.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our number, 866-440-8466, all across the United States. I'm going to drop into our live chat room. You can go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there within reason. And just click the link to the live chat, what do you call it, product, place, page, there you go. And it'll get you in there. Or you can drop by our blog, our message area, and post. And speaking of blogs, this ABC docudrama that I was telling you about a few minutes ago, that Richard Clark is blasting. He's saying, you know, if it's contrary to the movie, contrary to the movie, contrary to the movie. Well, ABC is providing advanced copies. It's called Path to 9/11. They're providing advanced copies of it to right-wing bloggers. And they're going to have a conference call promoting the film. But if you are a progressive blogger, a liberal, heaven forbid, or maybe somebody who actually knows something about what actually happened, maybe a former member of the Clinton administration, maybe Richard Clark. If you really know what happened, no. You are not invited. In fact, FireDogLake.com, the blog, FireDog's blog, Outrageous Deception by Jennifer Nix. She says, I smelled something rotten emanating from the Mickey Mouse Network. Having worked a variety of years back, I got the old Rolodex out and started making calls and sending emails. By mid-morning yesterday, I'd gotten the name of the exec in charge, Steve McPherson, his direct phone line. I sent email requests to 2 ABC flacks and 3 PR company flacks listed in the company's online press release. She goes through all. Apparently, it was impossible for all 5 of these people to answer me during business hours, East or West Coast. So let's review. This very high-profile movie is airing next weekend, and all 5 of the listed contacts are out all day yesterday, making it impossible to get advanced copies. This after the ABC made the miniseries available to a plethora of right-wing nut bloggers and media personalities like Mr. Limbaugh. How very odd. These are the exact words of ABC's Allison Rowe, left on my voicemail. Again, this is from the blog of Jennifer Nix over at FireDogLake.com. We are certainly happy to send a copy of Path to 9/11 to you. It's a, there's no, you know, we're not sending it only to specific partisan groups or bloggers who lean a certain political way. We'd love to get it to you as well. Unfortunately, everyone's gone today. But we can get it out to you Tuesday or Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Yeah. According to Sheldon Rampton over at PRWatch.org, the screenwriter is an avowed conservative and personal friend of Rush Limbaugh, and the project is fronted by the Republican chair of the 9/11 Commission. She says, I ask you, ABC, where are the Democratic contributors to this nonpartisan project? And whose idea was it to send preview copies to right-wing partisan bloggers while excluding leftist partisans from viewing this public service project? Was it your network or MPPRM, the firm you hired to execute the outreach campaign? If it is indeed so nonpartisan, why is the Democratic co-chair of the 9/11 Commission not out front in this thing, giving it his official okay? And one more thing, is Kane, Thomas Kane a paid consultant? If so, how much is he making by trading off his work as a former 9/11 commissioner? Well, we'll see. Today is the conference call, and I suspect somebody is going to figure out a way to get in. You know, some progressive is going to get in on that. Meanwhile, as they note over at Think Progress, Matt Drudge, it just never ends. You know, is pushing a story claiming, quote, the world's top climate scientists have cut their worst case scenario for global warming over the next 100 years. Yeah, well, once again, a reporter has misinterpreted the data. You get, you know, good science data, and you give it to right-wing reporters, and strange things happen. Strange things happen. By the way, just to kind of wrap up this hour here on a bizarre note. We started out with religion. Let's close it up with religion. Larissa Alexandrova over at The Raw Story, quoting from a new book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. We'll be talking with one of the authors. It's by James Moore and Wayne Slater tomorrow, actually. According to the Dallas Morning News, the Austin American Statesman, Governor George W. Bush, governor of Texas at the time, he says, you know what I'm going to tell those Jews when I get to Israel, don't you, Herman? When the journalist Ken Herman replied that he didn't know, Bush reportedly delivered the punchline, I'm telling them they're all going to hell. Yeah. Back in 1993, in fact, he had told the Houston Post that, only those people who accept Jesus Christ go to heaven. Now, the Catholic Church has backed away from this position. They did so under John Paul II and said, well, yeah, it's possible that Jews can go to heaven. But apparently George Bush hasn't. The authors of The Architect assert that religion and ethnicity have been manipulated by Bush and Rove to divide and conquer the nation. Gee, what a surprise. The quip never made wider media attention, although the Austin American Statesman reported it in December of 1998. It took us a while to figure this out, apparently. 57 minutes before the hour, or after the hour, 3 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more news. I got to tell you, and what's going on in Iraq, it's just amazing, this new report out from the Pentagon. Share some information about that with you. We'll be taking your calls right after this.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The program we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker and Scotty McClellan is the press secretary. Yes. Entry-level wages for college and high school graduates fell by, not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, fell by more than 4% from 2001 to 2005 after factoring in inflation. This from Stephen Greenhouse in yesterday's New York Times. I mean, this is the state of the economy as a consequence of 26 years now of Republican economic policies. And, yeah, I know Bill Clinton was president for 8 years, but at least half of his economic policies were also Republican, conservative economic policies. His whole flat earth thing, you know, buying into the thing from the multi-billionaire Tom Friedman that, maybe the best thing for billionaires is the best thing for all of us. Sorry, ain't so. Here's the basic story. Here's how it lays out. Entry-level wages for college and high school graduates fell by more than 4%. From 2001 to 2005, after factoring in inflation. In addition, the percentage of college graduates receiving health and pension benefits in their entry-level jobs has dropped sharply. Some labor experts say wage stagnation and the sharp increase in housing costs over the past decade have delayed workers ages 20 to 35 from buying their first homes. It's like everything is being moved back. Why? Because it's harder and harder to have a life these days. People, as Cecilia Rouse, an economist at Princeton University, co-editor of a forthcoming book on the economics of early adulthood, she says, people are getting married later, they're having children later, they're buying houses later. There's been a lengthening of the transition to adulthood. Why? Because of what has happened in the economy. The median income for families with at least one parent age 25 to 34, fell between 2000 and 2005, fell $3,009. Whereas throughout the 1990s, the Clinton years, it had jumped, the median family income for a family where at least one parent was between 25 and 34 had jumped 12%. Now they've fallen over $3,000, a 5.9% drop. Stephen Greenhouse goes on to add, worsening the financial crunch, far more college graduates are borrowing to pay for their education, and the amount borrowed has jumped by more than 50% in recent years. But what does that get you if you graduate from college? Well, from 2001 to 2005, again, the Bush years, entry-level wages for male college graduates fell 7.3%. Wages for female college graduates fell 3.5%. The percentage of young adults, again, this from the New York Times, this piece by Stephen Greenhouse, many entry-level workers find a rough market. The percentage of young adults who are working has dropped since 2000, largely because so many have grown discouraged and stopped looking for work. Well, what happens when you get discouraged and stop looking for work? You're no longer counted as unemployed, even though you don't have a job. In fact, as the New York Times notes, this has happened even though the unemployment rate, which counts only people looking for work, has fallen to 4.4% for those ages 25 to 34. It's 8.2% for workers ages 20 to 24. In a steep drop over a short time, 64% of college graduates received health coverage and entry-level jobs last year compared with 71% 5 years earlier. So it used to be you graduate from college, 71% of the people who graduated from college got a job with health care. Now you graduate from college, 64% get a job with health care. Partly because of the decline in manufacturing jobs, notes Greenhouse over at the New York Times, partly because of the decline in manufacturing jobs that were a ticket to a middle-class life, just one-third of workers with high school diplomas received health coverage and entry-level jobs, down from two-thirds in 1979. I would remind you that was the year before Ronald Reagan became president and declared war on working people in America. They also note the nation's personal savings sank below zero last time for the first time since the Depression, meaning Americans spent more money than they earned. Nationally, the average was about 1%, but for households under 35, the savings rate has plunged to minus 16%. They're spending 16% more than they're earning. Not a good sign. Now, I've been trying to come up with a metaphor to explain all this. You know, a way to understand it. Imagine that there was a frontier community in early America. And they had farms, enough farms that they could provide all the food to the community, and they had a blacksmith who was making the making the wagon wheels and the horseshoes and things like that, and they had a little smelting operation there of iron ore. You know, they're mining some iron ore and maybe mining some coal, and they're making their own iron, and they're self-sufficient by and large. They got plenty of trees, building houses, making their own nails. Let's say that they have nearby, you know, cotton fields growing. Let's say they're, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line. They're making their own clothes. They're self-sufficient. The way, you know, for example, all Native American communities were self-sufficient. So we have this self-sufficient community. And nobody's really rich. Nobody's really poor. It's not communism or anything like that. It's just, you know, everybody plays a role and everybody has something to do and everybody's, you know, doing okay. And somebody in the community says, well, you know, we're buying our horseshoes from this horseshoe guy from our local blacksmith. And there's these guys who are mining the ore to make the iron, and there's the iron smelting operation, and all of that is, you know, there's like 15, 20 people here in the town employed in that line of work that leads to the horseshoe and the wagon wheels and the steel. And there's a community down the road where they just do nothing but make steel. We can just buy the steel from them. And, you know, we can trade them some of our wheat for it. And so let's go into the business of growing more wheat and not making steel anymore. What has happened? Now the community is no longer self-sufficient. Now the community is dependent upon the guys down the road who make the steel. And they're buying their wheat from us, so we're getting wheat heavy and steel light, right? But the people down the road from us, they're buying their wheat not just from us, they're buying it from a whole bunch of folks. So they're not putting themselves in a position where they're absolutely dependent, but we have. And we also just threw 16 people out of work. So our economy is starting to get dislocated. There are these twists occurring. And the guy who's bringing the steel in, he's got an exclusive deal with the community down the road. And he's saying, you know, all the steel has to come through me. I'm the only guy who can sell steel here. And he starts jacking the price up. And pretty soon the community starts getting poorer and poorer, and this guy starts getting richer and richer. And the people down the road who are selling us the steel, they start raising their prices as well. And now we're having to work harder and harder. And see, this is like a micro metaphor for free trade. It's an imperfect one, and if you have a better idea, I'd love to hear it, because I'm trying to work this out in my head in a way that I could explain it to a fifth grade class, because that's really what we have to get it down to if I'm going to convert this thing into an op-ed for the New York Times, so that it's really simply understood, because really that community is a metaphor for the United States. When Reagan became president, the United States was self-sufficient by and large. We made our own missiles, we made our own clothing, we made our own steel, we produced all our own food. We certainly had the ability to. We were producing most of our own oil. We were exporting oil in the United States until the 1970s, you'll recall. We were self-sufficient. And Reagan changed all that. Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, they changed all that. With this idea of the olive tree and the Lexus, of free trade. Somehow free trade is going to help the rest of the world. Well, what about us? And for that matter, from every country in the world's point of view, what about them? Shouldn't we be helping individual communities become self-sufficient in this model? Having a chance to participate? It seems just commonsensical to me. It just seems to make reasonable sense. We'll be checking in with Talk Radio News after this, and then we'll be taking your calls on this and other topics. 866-440-8466. 16 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program.
I'm sorry for the wilderness, but something had to go. And here's a consolation prize. Cute Derek's in a row. I love that happy sound. You still can view the grizzly bear, proud mama and her cub. You'll see them on the postage stamp of a Sierra Cub.
Minutes past the hour, the place where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 22 minutes past the hour. And Victoria Jones, the senior White House correspondent with TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I understand the gaggle was canceled this morning because why?
Well, we had a gaggle. We had to wait 30 minutes for the gaggle, which was pretty annoying, but eventually we did have one. The briefing itself was canceled. It was canceled because the president is going to be delivering these remarks on the global war on terror, which he's doing right now, so he is actually competing with you, Tom.
You should
know that.
I'm horrified.
You have competition right now. Yeah, you should know you have competition.
This is going to be tough.
Yeah, it is tough. It is. It's tough for him to be going up against you, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is what he's doing is he's rolling out the election strategy for November 2006, which is
Yes. Don't
talk about domestic policy. Stop talking about immigration. It's hurting us. Stop talking about all these other things, and let's whip up as much fear as we possibly can. It worked for Hitler. It'll work again.
That's exactly right. And if necessary, let's use Hitler in whatever way we like. And if necessary, we'll use the Nazis, and as indeed we saw last week, and really quite effectively. The White House has this new booklet out called the Combating Terrorism, which is an update of its last report on combating terrorism that came out in 2003. And part of the gaggle this morning was Fran Townsend, who is the Homeland Security advisor for the White House. She was there, and she became a large part of this morning's gaggle.
She's the woman who used to be the Pentagon spokesman, isn't she?
Did she?
Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. Okay.
I think you may be thinking of somebody else. She used to be in the Justice Department. She's very, very bright, very, mm-hmm. very bright, very, very capable person, really does know her stuff and stays absolutely on message all the way through.
Mm.
And indeed did. But it was interesting. The questions were asked, which is why is this report coming out 6 days before September the 11th? And is it not political that this report's coming out basically on the first day of the political campaign season? And we were assured by Tony Snow that no, there really was nothing political about this. This report had been in the works for months, and it just happened to be ready now.
Gee, what a coincidence.
And we should be assured about that and not be concerned.
Yes, yes, no doubt about it. Now, the ABC, the Disney Network, is going to be rolling out a movie, The Path to 9/11 or something like this, that Rush Limbaugh has been gushing about. Apparently a friend of his wrote the movie. It blames Clinton for 9/11. Think Progress, Center for American Progress, got a hold of Richard Clark and found that the movie, in the part of the movie where they're about to corner bin Laden and they've got him and they call up Clinton and say, can we kill him? And Clinton says, no, you can't, in the movie. Or Sandy Berger, on behalf of Clinton, says, no, you can't. Richard Clark says, not only did that not ever happen, but the exact opposite happened. Clinton told the CIA, if you ever get a chance to kill this guy, do it.
I'm speechless, which is not a good thing to be on radio. I'm kind of stunned. I'm kind of stunned that that actually is going to air.
Yeah, I am too.
It's
just incredible. The debunking of it is happening. And also, all the right-wing blogs and right-wing talk show hosts got advanced copies of it. None of the progressive ones did. There's a conference call today. All the right-wing bloggers and right-wing talk show hosts are invited to it. None of the progressives are. I mean, it's like the Disney Network is taking, ABC, is taking a political position on 9/11.
Which sounds like it is. Has anybody spoken to ABC or got a statement out of them about this?
If you go over to thinkprogress.org, there is a form where you can fill it in and email ABC saying, you know, please tell the truth about 9/11 instead of this hooey. But that's about as close as it gets. They had a blog up for this program, and people started confronting the author of the program, the author of the screenplay, this guy that Rush Limbaugh describes as a close friend. They started confronting him about some of the inaccuracies, untruths, and outright lies in this program that ABC will be airing on September 10th and September 11th. And he said, hey, it's just a movie. We don't say it's true. It's drama. There's, you know, the word drama means drama, right?
Oh, my God.
And then ABC took the blog down.
Oh, my God.
So the blog's not there anymore. So, I thought you'd want to know. I thought it might provide some fertile ground for some future questions at the White House. You know, did you guys work with ABC on this? What do you think about a national network spinning 9/11 in a way that's favorable to the White House and looks bad for Bill Clinton when, in fact, it's based on lies, you know, those kinds of things?
Free speech.
There you go. Yeah, indeed. Corporate free speech. Victoria Jones, our senior White House correspondent. Thanks for being with us. Thank you, Victoria. Coming up next, a tribute to a great environmentalist and animal rights activist, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on how we can frame a metaphor for global free trade. 27 minutes past the hour.
How many wrinkles in a pickle? How many hairs in a hair? How many waves in the ocean? How many crumbs in bread? But last but not least, bed and most. Mumble every time you call, because you're strange to me, baby.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Australian Steve Irwin, conservationist, TV star, mourned after a fatal stingray encounter. Brian Casey with the Associated Press writes, Steve Irwin died doing what he loved best, getting too close to one of the dangerous animals he dedicated his life to protecting with an irrepressible, effervescent personality. that propelled him to global fame as television's Crocodile Hunter. His wife, Terry Raines, is from Eugene, Oregon, which is a city where we're, this program is on the air, and our consolations to Terry and her family. She was a naturalist in her own right when she visited the Australia Zoo in 1991 and met the outback outdoorsman whom she would marry 8 months later. Footage from their crocodile trapping honeymoon became the first episode of The Crocodile Hunter. Here's a little clip from one of Steve Irwin's programs, not that one in particular, but from one of Steve Irwin's programs, our memorial, our tribute to a conservationist and all-around good guy.
And he's putting up a bit of a fight, a bit of a thrash. It's not too bad. I think he knows what he's got. I'm 6 foot, he's 6 foot. I'm 210 pounds, and he'd be about 67. Come on, mate, come on. Now that I've got him top-jawed, let's see if I can pin him down. Right, go, Steve-O. Woo! Strike him. But I'm not taking any chances. I push his head away because he could slice me right in the head. I just got to hang on to him. Oh, he's bit me. That's it. I've been bitten, but it was a simple nip. Get off me. Leave me alone. All he did was a recalibratory nip. Nothing but a nip. And all he wants to do is move away. How's that for pushing it to the limit? How's that for taking it beyond all the boundaries? I've top-jaw roped him. Twice I tried to nail him, wrestle him, hang on to him. It's just too greasy.
There he is, Steve Irwin. And that was, he was all alone in a muddy river in Australia trying to grab a crocodile. So Steve Irwin stung by a stingray in the chest and leaves behind an 8-year-old daughter, Bindi Sue, and a 2-year-old son, Robert Clarence. And good guy. It's a shame. Yeah, he was a TV star and all that, but I think that came out of his being a good guy fundamentally. You know, there are some people who rise to success or fame or whatever the right word is, I don't know, as a consequence of their actually being good, decent people who are doing important work, and I think he was frankly one of them. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466. Gordon is that Gulfport, Mississippi, or Guthport?
Guthport, yes.
Guthport. Hey, Gordon, what's up?
An idea. You're a shining light, Mr. Hartman, in an ever-darkening society. And I have an idea that would help focus that a little bit. Consider having a segment periodically you titled News, Not News, and then give examples of things that come across the wire that are available to Mr. Rome Hartman at CBS News and his counter at ABC and NBC. For example, a senator who blocks legislation that would allow us to find out where the governor is spending our money.
Yeah, that should be big news.
Comes across his desk, and then we have a pregnant panda bear in a zoo in San Diego. Mr. Hartman says, yeah, that's news. The senator, not news.
Yeah.
And then just go from one example to another.
That's a great segment suggestion, Gordon. You know who's really doing a good job of that, actually, is FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, their website, and Media Matters, MediaMatters.org.
Yes.
And we do from time to time use segments from them. That's a good one. One of these days when we get a little larger staff.
The main thing I think that I want to get across, Mr. Hartman, is that we need to focus in on this guy, Rome Hartman, and his other two counterparts. There are three men in our entire society who have the power to censorship what you and I learn about what's going on. Yeah. These three men, there's just an enormous number of people in our society that don't have time for anything other than the evening news, and they filter everything. And because they're so intent on being information, I mean, not being journalists, but being entertainment, that our society is not informed.
Yeah, well, they're intent on making money, actually. And what they've found is that news doesn't make as much money as infotainment. And there, occasionally you find programs where there's actually a mix of news and infotainment that works and gets ratings. I think Keith Olbermann has done a very good job of that, for example. But it takes him an hour to do it, and they're trying to do these half-hour newscasts, and it's a really tough one. Gordon, thanks for the call. Great suggestion and interesting one. Jeff in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jeff, you want to disagree with me?
Yes, Tom. I haven't called in quite a while, but anyway, I listened to you ranting about the movie and ABC's airing it. For the longest time, you say they don't cover the news. Now they cover the news, and now you want to call them a liar.
They're not covering the news. They're not even saying that they're covering the news, Jeff. They are saying, ABC is saying on its website, this is a work of fiction. This is a drama. You understand what the word drama means.
Okay. I understand that, but the fact that you're bringing up Richard Clark and
Richard Clark is saying that this drama has lies in it, and so I'm asking the question, why is ABC airing a drama about 9/11 that makes Clinton look bad, makes Bush look good, just before an election that, according to Richard Clark, is full of lies? Why would they do that?
But
do you have any idea, Jeff?
Because what ABC is putting out is the truth, and
the guy who wrote it is not saying the truth. He's saying, hey, it's a movie. Get over it.
There's so much crap in the last few months from all these people that no one actually can tell who is lying. Everything that, let's see, people are saying, either side, you suspect is not the truth.
Jeff, you've got the 9/11 commission that was put together by Democrats and Republicans, and this disagrees with the 9/11. I was reading to you from the text of the 9/11 Commission, the actual book that they published, when I was laying out the facts of what happened. And then I was quoting to you from Rush Limbaugh describing what's in the movie, which is a completely different thing. You've got a movie that is apparently, I haven't seen it, so I'm not speaking from firsthand knowledge, but according to Rush Limbaugh, we have a movie which says something quite different from what the 9/11 Commission says is truth. And when the producer of the movie was confronted with that on the ABC blog, his response was words to the effect of, hey, it's a drama.
But
we changed things around. I mean, that's what you do in a drama. You can't, you know, you're going to tell the story of 9/11. It's going to take you years to do that. We had a couple of hours. We had to collapse
people like
time
Richard
and
Clark
combine
has
characters.
His own horn to do, and, you know, it's not unforeseeable that he would lie or twist the truth also. Clinton, the one that you quote from saying all these things, he definitely is a liar. So you can't believe a single word he say either. I mean, no one actually can say that.
Jeff, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
You ever lied about having sex?
Have you
ever lied about having sex?
I don't believe so, but I never had to. But he didn't.
Well, you're a rare man, Jeff. I got to say, you're a rare man. I'm sorry. Lying about whether or not you had sex in the White House is a whole different thing about lying people into a war and lying about the 9/11. I think that lying about 9/11 is a really big deal, frankly.
All these little things that you're quoting as he lied about sex. He did not get impeached for lying about Monica Lewinsky.
Yes, he did. He got impeached for lying before a grand jury about whether or not he had sex with Monica Lewinsky.
Jennifer Flowers.
You're right. It was Jennifer Flowers.
Okay.
But in any case, he got impeached for lying before a grand jury and about sex. And
no,
so
well,
what?
It was about him trying to take.
How many people died, Jeff, as a result of Bill Clinton's lie?
Okay.
One? Can you name one?
Well, I know that.
I have pictures on my wall of people who died as a result of George W. Bush's lies.
Or he could have made a mistake in his judgment about it. I mean,
who?
Bush. I mean.
Oh, he just made a mistake of judgment when he lied to us.
He could have gotten information that he made a decision on that made him a mistake. But to constantly try to bash him and not.
I'm not trying to bash him, Jeff. I'm pointing out the truth.
No, but
the truth is that Bill Clinton, to take it back to the movie, the truth is that according to Richard Clark and according to the 9/11 Commission, according to all the evidence that's in the public record and has been certified by the Bush administration, the truth is that Bill Clinton had standing orders to the CIA to kill bin Laden whenever they saw him, wherever they saw him, that he never said, no, don't kill bin Laden. And in the movie, you've got Sandy Berger and Bill Clinton saying, oh, no, don't take
Berger
him out.
Sandy Berger that snuck papers out of the Congress library. I mean,
Sandy Berger, who was the national security advisor. You're going to go off on another character assassination another irrelevant point, Jeff. It still doesn't change the reality of the situation that you have we have a movie here that ABC is putting out, which is not characterizing accurately what happened in 9/11, which is pinning blame on Bill Clinton, which is completely apparently largely overlooking the Bush administration's failures with regard to 9/11, and some would suggest way beyond failures. And you just have to ask why. Why would a big multinational corporation do that? 45 minutes past the hour.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss. It just don't get any better than this.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bob in Ashfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. I was just calling about the Katie Couric thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't see anybody cover this, but there was an episode last year when the Abramoff scandal first broke in the mainstream media, mm-hmm. and she was interviewing him in the morning. Did you hear anything about that?
She was interviewing Jack Abramoff?
No, she was interviewing Howard Dean.
Oh, Howard Dean. No, I didn't see that.
He started by saying that this was essentially a Republican scandal, and before he could finish what he was saying, she cut him off in a very heavy-handed sort of condescending way, said, hey, there's tons of Democrats that are involved in this, too. And he was quite taken back by it, and I was I didn't know what to think about it. The next day, Howard Dean's back on, and Matt Lauer was apologizing for Katie Couric to Howard Dean.
Oh, interesting. In fact, here's
her complete, she didn't really, for somebody who's even a morning news anchor, she should have, more comprehensive knowledge of current events.
Yeah, you would think.
She didn't have the spine to go apologize to him herself.
Here's Howard Dean and his current take on the situation, by the way.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
And David, my producer, tells me that's the actual clip from the Katie Couric interview.
Yeah, so. And the only other thing I want to say, Tom, you've inspired me. I got letters and leaflets going out all over the place. The town clerk has the Bobby Kennedy article. And your analogy is with the village is pretty good. Just keep working on it a little.
It's a starting point.
Okay?
Yeah, great.
Thanks,
Bob,
a lot,
thanks
Tom.
A lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Connie in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Connie, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was curious. I've been hearing a lot on the blogs regarding this docudrama.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hear other people saying, well, give it a chance. You don't know. I mean, they're saying that part one is kind of heavy against Clinton, and then part two is heavy against Bush. I don't want to give them viewership to form that opinion, frankly.
Yeah.
I was curious whether you will be watching this.
I will not.
Okay.
I can just tell you that right now.
I'd love a review from somebody.
When I read on the ABC blog the screenwriter saying this is a drama, not a documentary. I've seen enough drama in my life. Thank you very much. I don't even like going to movies unless they have a happy ending. I saw The Illusionist this weekend. It was a wonderful movie because it had a happy ending. If I'm going to be entertained, I want to feel good at the end of the entertainment.
Absolutely.
I don't like going to tragic movies. I don't like crying and sobbing, and I don't really, frankly, want to relive 9/11.
Yes.
And particularly for the benefit of the Bush administration.
Well, if it's as bad as everybody is thinking it's going to be, I would like to know the people that are advertising during this.
Yeah.
I really would.
And to generate a little blowback.
Right.
Well, the main blowback will be if the ratings are, in the toilet. And frankly, I came into this with some trepidation because there is the reality that by my talking about it, I am heightening its visibility. On the other hand, and I really appreciate your raising the issue, Connie, I do not intend to watch it. yeah. on ABC. I've, for that matter, I don't watch ABC Evening News any longer.
No.
I don't watch any of the network news any longer because it has all become pablum. I mean, it's pathetic. I'll watch news on public broadcasting. BBC now has a news report in the United States. Amy Goodman does a great job of reporting the news. I mean, the networks are not the place to go for news anymore because it's all become, and Keith Olbermann does a good job, but everything else has become infotainment.
And isn't that a shame?
It's not just a shame, it's a crime against democracy. Jefferson was right. You can't have a democracy without an educated and informed populace, and we have lost that, and it's a tragedy. It's a real tragedy. Connie, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
it.
Good to hear from you. Rami in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Rami.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to speak to you a little about North Korea, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be going nowhere with these six-party talks, and I'm viewing it as we might end up having a war with them by mistake because one country or another will end up doing something stupid. Like we might have a repeat of what happened in 2003 where the North Koreans chased one of our reconnaissance aircrafts that was flying near their coastline.
Mm-hmm.
Or, maybe North Korea will do a nuclear test, and that's all that our peace-loving president will need to start an incident with them.
It would be a tragedy because really if we want to be concerned about world peace, number one, we should be talking to Kim Jong-il. We should be working with him. We should be helping him get what he really wants, which is, you know, food for his people and some certainty that he's not going to be overthrown and be working to bring some small incremental, at least at the very beginning, democratic reforms to that country in exchange for cutting down on the nuclear program, which is what Clinton did. You know, Clinton said, yeah, we'll give you some aid. You stop the nuclear program. It's not the best of all worlds, but at least the guy wasn't going nuke. But I think if we really want to be looking at the dangers in the world, number one, we need to be securing the former Soviet Union's nuclear sites. There's nuclear weapons all over the world right now where you can walk in with a pair of wire cutters or bolt clippers and just walk off with nuclear materials or a nuclear bomb. And number two, we should be doing everything we can to stabilize Pakistan. I'm very, very concerned about that. You've got Pervez Musharraf is hanging on by a thread, this guy, a military dictator. He has no claim to legitimacy in that country. He overthrew a democratically elected president. He's very unpopular. He's got like a 5, 10, 15% popularity rating among the people. And there's a strong, strong and growing Islamic movement against him. Plus, he's harboring Osama bin Laden, the guy who we're supposed to be wanted dead or alive. I mean, and he has nukes and he has the ability to deliver them. And then, so what does Bush do? He goes over and he says, okay, India, enemy of Pakistan, we'll give you some more nuclear weapons. Man, it's crazy. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Bioneers. No, not pioneers. Bioneers. A nonprofit organization that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Founded in 1990. Co-founder Kenny Ossibel, he's with us, an award-winning journalist, filmmaker, social entrepreneur, whose books include The Bioneers, A Declaration of Interdependence, and When Healing Becomes a Crime, The Amazing Story of the Hoxie Cancer Clinics and the Return of Alternative Therapies. He co-founded Seeds of Change and founded Inner Tan Productions, a feature film development company. Hey, Kenny.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm just great. Great to have you on the program. We see each other, it seems, once a year at the Bioneers Conference, which is always a hoot, and it's just marvelous to have you on with us. I wanted to talk a little bit, unless there's something on your agenda in particular that you wanted to get out here. Maybe I should first ask you that.
No, I'm at your pleasure here.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about Bioneers. This year you've got the conference coming up in October. People can find out all about it at bioneers.org. I'll be speaking there. There's a bunch of other folks who are speaking there. What do you see as the primary pivot point, the primary fulcrum for social and political change in the United States and around the world? How can we bring peace to this generation?
Well, you ask the easy questions, don't you, Tom?
That's my job, Ken.
You know, what strikes me right now, it's sort of an exercise in cognitive dissonance. It's a good way to try to hold contradiction, you know, is that on the one hand, things are deteriorating really into the red zone, certainly environmentally, and obviously the world is, you know, marked by war and totalitarian and dysfunctional governments, and it's a mess and it's getting worse. On the other hand, what's also arising is a countervailing force, and it's coming from the ground up. I mean, a lot of where I see the hope right now is locally and regionally, at least in this country, but this is a citizen movement that's global in scope, that is absolutely everywhere, and that's getting bigger, you know, day by day. In some ways, the biggest problem is the absolute disconnect between the will of the people and government policy, you know. And at the core of a lot of that, in my opinion, is the most profound corruption we've seen since the robber barons and the Gilded Age.
Well, and what's interesting about it, Kenny Ossibel, is that they don't view it as corruption. They view it as this is how it's supposed to be. There should be the wealthy who get wealthier, and there should be the working masses who stay relatively poor because it keeps them politically disempowered.
That's exactly right. No, they're definitely on a mission. It's class war, and it's undeclared, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's most certainly what's going on. But the corruption is really beyond belief at this point. So in some ways, that may be the stickiest point that we have to deal with. But, you know, everywhere people are reclaiming power at the local and regional levels and just doing kind of a Washington, D.C. bypass, you know.
Yeah, and that is one of the hopeful things, and it's one of the things that I get so much when I come to the Bioneers Conference, and you know, the information on your website and the radio program that you guys produce, and I mean, there's just all kinds of, you guys are out there with the message. What you we're talking with Kenny Ossibel, the co-founder of Bioneers, bioneers.org, the website. Kenny, in some regards, you know, folks view you as an icon. You know, here's this Kenny guy. He's done all this amazing stuff. He's, you know, he's incredible. I could never do that. Where does somebody start?
You know, my life has been so weird and so unexpected. I'm certainly not an icon in my own mind. I kind of grope through the day, probably like most people, frankly. But for myself, my entry into a lot of this work was I had a very severe health crisis that was not able to be helped by conventional medicine. And out of desperation, not out of any, you know, philosophical bias, I ended up probing alternative medicine and got tremendous help from that. And one thing led to another. And in the course of that, of course, when you start to think about your personal health, you realize that it's very closely connected to the environment, to the well-being of the how and where we live. I ended up discovering I'd had a very severe chemical exposure and spent many years, you know, getting better from that.
Mm-hmm.
And once you make those kinds of connections, you know, I really started to learn a lot. I educated myself. I read everything I could get my hands on. I talked to everybody who'd had direct experiences around health and environment. And at the end of the day, I really decided that I wanted to give something back of what I'd learned and see if it could help other people. It's a very simple motivation. And, you know, when people ask, what can I do? I mean, really the first thing to do is to make a commitment that you're going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it's a matter of learning.
And then it appears.
You know, pardon?
And then it appears.
That's right. I mean, life has a way of opening doors for you once you set an intention. You know, the world in a lot of ways right now is suffering from what I call intention deficit disorder.
I love it.
And once you set an intention, amazing things happen. You know, I never would have predicted my life in any way, and it continues right now as we speak. You just never know what's around the corner. But once you know you need to go in a certain direction and that you want to give back. I mean, I think so much of the world is set up around an exploitive model about taking, and people take and take and take, and really you have to also give back, you know, and it's a great pleasure and joy to give back.
It can
any
be
parent
actually,
knows that, you know.
Yeah.
But once you, I think it's really important. We all have very different passions and very different gifts, and if you really tune into your heart and what really moves you and then start to educate yourself and reach out and find who else is out there working on these things, you know, the path will open.
And that's one of the great things about the conference that you do every year, out in California. One of the themes that I touch on in a couple of my books is the idea that a war on nature inevitably becomes a human war against humans, that we can't separate our violence against other living things or our violence against our biosphere from our violence against each other. What, first of all, if you agree with that, if not, please, correct me. But if so, what are the, or who are the people who are doing things, or what are the institutions that are doing things, or what are the paradigm shifts that you see, that you're actually seeing, that you're reporting about, that are, you know, folks who are showing up at the Bioneers Conference, you know, showing up on your radio program, things like that, that can help bring about that peace that comes about as we reconcile ourselves with the rest of the world?
Well, I completely agree with your statement. In fact, I work very closely with some Native American friends who are Okanagan from Western Canada, and their cultural tradition and belief is that actually what we do to each other is what we do to the planet. It's exactly the same. You know, the wounds that we carry, that we inflict on the earth, are our personal wounds.
Yeah.
And without attending to that, we're just going to keep repeating that cycle. And, you know, if there's one fatal illusion in the world today, it's the illusion of separateness. And certainly from a biological or ecological viewpoint, what you quickly understand is that everything is connected. Life is a web of intricate and infinite connection. And so when you disturb one part of it, you disturb everything. And in the same way, once you really grasp that idea, there are no separate issues. They're all one issue at the end of the day. And I think what you're saying is correct, that the issue really is peace, is how to come back into harmony with not only the natural world, but with other people. And it doesn't mean you have to like everybody. I mean, that's never going to happen. It means that you have mutual respect and that everybody wants peaceful coexistence. You know, we just have to respect and allow each other to be. We don't really have to like everybody.
And at a certain level, it has to do with how we organize our political institutions, our economic institutions, and our living institutions, you know, our way of life.
You bet. And, you know, in a world today where, I mean, we're never going to have peace with the environment when half the people in the world live on $2 a day or less. You know, it just ain't going to happen. So it benefits no one, you know, at that level.
Kenny, what's coming up at the Bioneers Conference this year?
Well, all kinds of good stuff, including, of course, you, Tom.
First of all, when and where?
It's in San Rafael, California, just near San Francisco, October 20th to the 22nd. 3 days, three wonderful days. And actually, we have, you know, Beaming Bioneers live satellite conferences across the country. There are 18 of them this year. And if you go to the bioneers.org website, you can see where those are in case it's in your neck of the woods. And we like to say these days, go to Bioneers, stay home, you know?
Yeah.
But one of the most interesting folks this year actually is going to be James Hillman, the Jungian psychologist, who is not only the heir to Carl Jung's work, but also has really advanced it in quite original ways. And
he's the author of the detective series.
No,
a different James Hillman.
Right, different one. No, yeah. He's written a lot about archetypes and the shadow, and you know, all kinds of good stuff. And what he's going to be talking about is he's looked back through American history, and the premise of the talk is that the country is not the government, that there are some very, very positive strains in American history, cultural threads that we can draw on to move this country politically right now. And then he'll be speaking on a panel with you as well, and I can't wait to hear that conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, too. Other things of note?
Yeah, well, Maria Elena Durazzo, who's done a lot of work around immigrant organizing and labor, we're doing labor stuff at Bioneers this year, really for the first time. We haven't delved into that nearly enough.
That's marvelous.
And
that's
so we programmed that before, of course, everything hit the fan this year, so we're proud of ourselves.
Good on you. Well, you're just by coincidence, ahead of the curve. Kenny Ossoval, the co-executive director and co-founder of Bioneers, bioneers.org, and read all about it. Kenny, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I'll see you soon.
Indeed. Looking forward to it. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Ghost chickens in the sky. Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. The Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour, and time to check out what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
security and other developments of Iraq, in Iraq, reported on Tuesday as of 10:30 Greenwich Mean Time. Dateline Suwayra. The bodies of five blindfolded men with multiple gunshot wounds and signs of torture were pulled out of the Tigris River. Baghdad, gunmen killed two Shiite pilgrims in the district of Dora as they were walking to a religious ceremony in Karbala. Near Latifia, gunmen killed one Shiite pilgrim and wounded three others south of Baghdad in that city. In Samarra, three civilians were killed and six others wounded when two roadside bombs struck a fuel tanker in a residential area. In Baghdad, Iraqi army and police commandos have detained 22 insurgents and 95 suspected insurgents in the last 24 hours in various areas of Iraq. In other developments, Iraq's parliament, in its first session since the summer recess, approved the extension of special powers to Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to combat violence. Measures such as curfews and military operations have been in place for the last 2 years. So much for democracy. And Washington, a U.S. Army investigator, has recommended that four soldiers be court-martialed over the rape and killing of a 14-year-old Iraqi girl and the slaying of three family members in a town south of Baghdad in March, a lawyer for one of the lawyers said on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a Pentagon report shows more violence in Iraq. The Pentagon released a report on Iraq Friday titled Measuring Security and Stability in Iraq. The conclusions are not pretty. Execution-style murders have killed thousands. Bloodshed is at its highest level in at least 2 years. This is the New York Times. And the number one goal of the U.S. military now is to prevent a full-on civil war. For example, over the last 3 months, Iraqi casualties are up 51%. More than 3,000 Iraqis are killed or wounded every month. That's more than all the people who died in 9/11. Die in Iraq, civilians, every month. The Baghdad coroner's office received 1,600 bodies in June and more than 1,800 in July, of which 90% were assessed to be the result of executions. There are 800 attacks a week in Iraq. That's nearly double the number from April of 2004, and many experts think it's the highest level since the war began. This all from the Pentagon report that was released on Friday. And also from the report, the core conflict area in Iraq is is a battle between Sunnis and Shiites where, quoting the Pentagon, death squads and terrorists are locked in mutually reinforcing cycles of sectarian strife, with Sunni and Shia extremists each portraying themselves as defenders of their respective sectarian groups. In the meantime, the Bush administration is trying to assert that they never said stay the course, that they're all about adapt to win. Adapt to win is the new, Frank Luntz has been doing his polling, apparently, and adapt to win is the new phrase, and so they really don't want you to remember that they ever said stay the course. In fact, according to Tony Snow the other day, no, we never said stay the course. We're all about adapt to win. Bush, stay the course? No, we would never say that. Come on, that's kind of dumb. Americans don't like that anymore. It doesn't poll well. No, we never said stay the course. We have always been in favor of adapt and win, not stay the course.
We will stay the course. We will complete the job in Iraq.
Well,
the second thing you do is you stay the course.
Well.
But on the other hand, you also cannot be a president in a wartime and not realize that you got to stay the course.
We will stay the course.
We will
stay the course until the job is done, Steve. And the temptation is to try to get the president or somebody to put a timetable on the definition of getting the job done. We're just going to stay the course. And my message today to those in Iraq is we'll stay the course.
People are going to want more of it, and that's why the president's determined to stay the course, April.
Well.
And that's why we're going to stay the course in Iraq.
Maybe he didn't say.
And that's why when we say something in Iraq, we're going to do it. And so we've got tough action in Iraq. But we will stay the course.
He never said that. In each one of those circumstances, each one of those situations where Tony Snow or George W. Bush was saying, stay the course, what he was really saying is adapt to win. But because of this weird warp in the woof of time and space, It was translated by your brain into Stay the Course. Because you've been indoctrinated by liberals, you see, in the mainstream media, the liberal press that's owned by, like, you know, the defense contractor, General Electric. Yeah, the liberal press, they just caused you to think that you heard Stay the Course. In fact, what you were hearing was Adapt to Win, and things are getting better. They're getting so much better. 27 minutes past the hour.
I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider. Coo-coo, coo-choo. Baghdad City policemen sitting pretty little targets in a row. See how they die when shrapnel flies. See mothers cry. I'm lying. I'm lying.
He's the decider. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. A place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Tom Hartman radio program. TomHartman.com for our live chat room, our message area, our blogs, and show archives and articles and all sorts of things. And 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Dan in Redmond, Washington, on the line. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi. First-time caller, Tom. I've been listening to your program for a while. It's interesting. What I want to know, I haven't heard anything talked about, is the concept of the terrorists attacked, assuming that they did, they attacked the trade centers. And the trade centers are a valuable target, but if they really wanted to instill fear into the country, I would think that they would attack something that would cause a lot more damage, like a nuclear power plant or a dam or something.
Well,
of that
let me just interrupt you in midstream here, Dan, with a little factoid. This from the 9/11 Commission report. Apparently, Mohammed Atta had originally planned on flying at least one and possibly two of the planes into the Indian Point nuclear power plant that's about 60 miles north of New York City, and which would have rendered an area, and you don't even actually have to hit the plant. You hit the pool next to it where the spent material is being stored. The spent material actually has more, you know, highly fissionable fractions in it, you know, the plutonium and U-235 that are left over. And it has no protection. You know, there's no concrete dome or anything. And it would be like a giant dirty bomb that would create a 200-300 mile radius area of absolute unlivable radiation for the next 250,000 years. He originally was planning on hitting that nuclear facility, and in the months before 9/11 decided not to, because he concluded that anything that, you know, that had that kind of potential to harm Americans must have surface-to-air missiles surrounding it. You know, it must be ringed with surface-to-air missiles. And he just made that assumption and decided instead to hit the World Trade Center. At least this is the official line according to the 9/11 report. And to this day, and by the way, I'm not like giving out information terrorists don't know. This was reported in the New York Times. To this day, there are no protections on any of the nuclear power plants in the United States.
Right. That makes sense. Well, okay, they attacked the trade centers, right? But they couldn't have known that the trade centers were going to collapse. Not even the builder knew what was going to happen when those planes were burning in the building.
Yeah.
So the thing that concerns me there is that why didn't they try to do something else? I mean, they could have dropped the plane into a football stadium or a dam or something else that would have caused a lot more damage, a lot more people lost, and that sort of thing. And that concerns me is that it seems to me they didn't attack us. They attacked the government.
Well, actually, they attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and there's considerable symbolism there. The World Trade Center, you know, many, many people in third world countries view our international trade policies and the World Trade Organization, which has no relationship to the World Trade Center, but, you know, in the minds of much of the rest of the world, it does. The World Trade Organization being basically an instrument of what some would refer to as imperialism. And number one. And number two, you know, they may well have thought that they were going to knock over the towers by hitting them with airplanes. I mean, that's a pretty big hit, a pretty ferocious hit. So
yeah.
You know, who knows what was in their mind? I frankly don't. I mean, they're gone now, but or at least according to some reports. I mean, it's,
right.
The stories are so muddied, and there's so much. There's such a tragic lack of good and serious investigation. I mean, we even shipped the steel from 9/11 off to China for recycling rather than keeping around the forensic evidence of the crime of the century.
So we know what happened. Yeah, right. That's the thing. I mean, if we knew exactly what happened, it would distill, it would get rid of a lot of mistrust in what's happening.
Yeah,
that really is a problem.
I agree, and we're not going to get any kind of transparency or an investigation out of this administration, I'll tell you. Dan, got to move along. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Tim in British Columbia. Hey, Tim.
Hello, Tom. I've been hearing a lot from some of the right-wing talking heads with regards to tax and spend liberals. And I was just thinking that perhaps the retort of that should be bought and paid for.
Or borrow and spend.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what these guys are all about. Reagan came into office, and our national debt was $1 trillion. It's now $9 trillion. Almost all of that was run up by two presidents, Reagan and Bush Jr.
Right.
And
so
that's pretty mind-boggling.
Spend your buying and paying for it.
Yeah, they are the borrow and spend cons. It's just and we're bought and paid for. Yeah, bought and paid for. But
you know, this is the retort that the liberals should use. That if you're saying that we're going to raise taxes, we're buying and paying for something.
Yeah, at least it's the pay as you go. Actually, is the system that Clinton was putting into place, and Bush made fun of it during the debate. He couldn't actually say it. He called it paygo. And as if it was like, you know, the name of an obscure renamed island or something. But, that's the tragedy of it all, is that our children and grandchildren are going to have to pay for the money that we borrowed in order to make the economy look good so that Republicans could get elected.
Right.
And frankly, I'm concerned that Democrats will take control of the House and Senate in 2006, and then within 6 months, we will be plunged into a Great Depression, because that's exactly the setup that the Republicans have prepared for us, and that the Democrats are going to take the rap for it. I mean, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. It was the first few months that I was doing this radio program. I'm forgetting the guy's name. There's one of these conservative philosophers, one of the more marginal ones, not particularly well known, who came up with what he calls the two Santa Claus theory, where the Republican Party is always the Santa Claus. You know, they come in, they cut taxes, and everybody thinks, oh, they're the Santa Claus. And then they leave power, and the Democrats raise the taxes, and the Republicans jump up and down and yell, hey, wait a minute, we're looking out for you. They still get to be Santa Claus. And the Democrats take the hit for the bad economic times. You know, Jimmy Carter suffering from Nixon borrowing money and spending it on Vietnam, although LBJ had a role in that as well. But Nixon was the one who really got into the borrowing. So in any case, it's an interesting times we live in.
I certainly hope that you can make some changes in November, because, you know, you could really get a chance to straighten out your country.
I agree. And I hope that your country, Mr. Harper, and your country seems to be going down the same road. You know,
I was really, really disappointed when I heard him make the comment of cut and run in one of his news conferences here in Canada. I thought, oh, my God, how could he be following the line?
He has some of the same advisors. This is one of our exports, that we're exporting Republican political advisors to Canada and to Mexico right now.
Right. Yeah. So, no, this is real scary on our part, because this guy's talking just like George. And
So you got some work to do there in BC, Tim.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for the call. Michael in Monroe. Hey, Michael.
Hello, Michael. Tom. What I'd like to do is just offer you a compliment, and don't really have any comments other than that. Can
it's
you
so,
hear me?
It's so much more fun, though, when people call me names. I mean, what did you want to say, Michael?
What it is earlier today you were commenting about the mainstream media, in particular television news, and kind of expressing a disappointment that, you know, when are they going to come around in that. And from, about 20 years of being very critical of and looking at the media, I would say that you're absolutely the best thing going. You have a particular way of delivering the information with intelligence. You've got your facts lined up. You've got historical references. You keep focusing back to our Constitution and for we the people. And I think more than anything, it's your way of being respectful to the callers that come in, even if they're from the right. You're very calm in your approach in talking with them, and not frightened.
Yeah, yes. Michael, thank you. Forgive me for contradicting you and interrupting you, but
okay.
You know, the compliments are appreciated, but at a certain point, everybody listening starts going.
Yeah.
You know, but I appreciate
right.
the call. Thank you very much. It's very kind of you. Rebecca in Langley. Hey, Rebecca.
Oh, hi. I really appreciate your show, and I could echo what this guy just said. But,
well, thank you.
But I'm mainly calling because I want to be sure your listeners know about Aaron Watada.
Yes, and thankyoult.com, the website,
right.
If you want to help out Aaron Watada. We played clips of him, in fact, last week. I think it was Friday on this program. And,
great.
And
uh-huh.
Yeah.
That he's scheduled to be court-martialed this fall for refusing to go to Iraq.
Yes.
And he's the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse deployment.
Yes.
So he hopefully will be starting a wave of other soldiers refusing to go. I think it could make a big difference.
I do too.
Iraq Veterans Against the War stood up with him in Seattle recently when he was speaking to the Veterans for Peace. So
That's great. Good on you, Rebecca. It's absolutely marvelous. Lieutenant Watada is doing an important thing. He took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution, and he's honoring that oath, in my opinion. 45 minutes past the hour.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
And welcome back here. Sel sent me this quote from George Orwell. He says, the Repugs will use this TV spin movie. We're talking about the ABC movie that's coming up that's already been thoroughly discredited over at thinkprogress.org. Quoting George Orwell, he who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future. Think about it. Just makes perfect sense. I mean, it's perfect sense. Keith in Marysville, California. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I was listening to your 9/11 story a little bit earlier, and it reminded me of what you had said a couple months back about the asbestos removal.
Refresh my memory.
I thought you said something about the city of New York had ordered the asbestos removal in the Twin Towers, and that was going to... going to cost more than building the Twin Towers.
That might have been one of our callers. I've heard that story. I wouldn't have said it as a statement of fact because I don't know it firsthand, but it may well be true. I just don't know.
Yeah, I like what you say about conspiracy theories. You're kind of agnostic about it. I think that's a pretty good idea.
Well, I'll tell you. You know, there's a 1,200 page book out right now with 2,400 footnotes in it. Called Ultimate Sacrifice, about the assassination of Jack Kennedy. Lamar Waldron and I worked on that book for 17 years. That's how long it took us to figure out who killed Kennedy and why. And so I can tell you, from having been in the middle of a conspiracy theory for 2 decades, that what you think is right, usually at the very early days, is usually ultimately wrong. And there are generally reasons for that, and people who have interests in making you think things that are wrong or right, and vice versa. But frankly, I think that the conspiracies around 9/11, and I use the plural because I think that there were more than one. Some of them, perhaps, conspiracies of convenience, make the Kennedy assassination look like a simple puzzle. And
I agree.
You know, and I have not done that research. I mean, I've seen all the videos, and I've had David Ray Griffin on this program several times, and others, But the fact of the matter is that I can't take an authoritative position because I have not done the firsthand research. My position is I don't know what the hell's going on with this. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff that's obviously being covered up. We don't know why. We don't know who. We know that the Bush administration is in it, up to their neck in it. But how or why or where? Is it just for convenience? Is it to cover up stupidity? Is it outright criminal malfeasance? Is it murder? I just don't know. And I hope someday the truth comes out. And I'm suspect that there are people out there who are doing with 9/11 what Lamar and I did with the JFK assassination. And I just hope it's not 40 years later that we learn.
Yeah, I agree. So you don't have any actual information about the state of New York ordering asbestos removal in the towers?
I don't. As I said, I've heard that, but I have not corroborated it. I can't say it as an authoritative source.
All right. Well, thanks for your information, and keep up the good work.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for the call, Keith. Good to hear from you. Jane in Seattle. Hey, Jane.
Hello.
Hey, Jane. You're live and on the air. Thank you for waiting.
I'm Jane. I've been waiting a long time to talk to you, Tom. I'm a first-time caller, and I love you a lot.
Well, thank you.
We're neighbors up here. I saw you when you were up in Seattle at the media forum.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
The reason I'm calling is not to talk about Iraq or George Bush, but to ask you some advice. I finished Greg Palast, Armed Madhouse, and I've got a long list of books, of course, because I'm a nation reader, too. And I write down everything. So I wanted to ask you what your top three recommended books might be for me to read next. David Sirota, I know Screwed, of course, The End of Iraq, and Peter Galbraith. And what would you think I should read next in order, three books that you think are valuable?
You know, I think that there are some books that are not the latest, greatest book out that are really important and worthy of digging into. If you go over to TomHartmann.com, and the website. And in the upper right-hand corner, there's a link. It says Articles on Democracy. And you go to that, and there's a collection of, 4 years' worth of columns that I've written for Common Dreams. But at the very top, there's another link which says Books Tom Recommends. And every month for about 2 years now, I've done a monthly book review for BuzzFlash.com because they support the website by selling books. And so this is my contribution to them, and a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And those are, I think, the most important books of the last couple of years.
Ditto to that guy that called a couple calls ago that was praising you. All the compliments you get you get stored up so that when the ignorant folks call you, you can, be moderate and your truth-telling.
Well, thank you, Jane.
I appreciate your time, sir. Look forward to listening to you every day.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's very kind of you, and thanks for the call. Leon in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Leon.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. We just have a minute left, by the way. I just wanted to speak out
in support of Senator Maria Cantwell here in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's a great senator. We don't agree with her on everything, but my goodness, she stood up to the oil companies. She's voted against both of Bush's Supreme Court nominees, and her opponent is laid off thousands at Safeco Insurance, and I personally know a retired department head at Safeco Insurance who thinks that her opponent, who is, in the Senate race, poisoned that company, poisoned it. And
no, Maria Cantwell, as you well know, I mean, there are a few issues where I disagree with Maria Cantwell.
Sure.
But she's a Democrat, and she's a reasonably good Democrat, and she's serving the state of Washington, I think, fairly well. And she should certainly be brought back into office. If I lived in Washington State, I'd vote for her in a heartbeat.
Sure.
So thanks a lot for the call, Leon. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Good to hear
Bye
from
now.
You. It's 56 minutes past the hour. Wrapping it up tomorrow, Greg Palast is going to be here interviewing me on my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And conservative Yaron Brook is going to tell us that humanitarian aid to the Lebanese people is a moral obscenity. I'm going to be saying, what? That and more. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information.